The grim numbers on the coronavirus continue to rise. As of this morning, the number of cases is working upward toward 29,000, with 565 deaths from the disease. As with any major disease outbreak, there's a lot of fear, often out of proportion to the good, solid information. Let's catch up on what is known. For that, we turn to a science journalist who has covered the outbreak of the novel coronavirus. Tanya Lewis is an associate editor at Scientific American who covers health and medicine. Tanya, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
So as I read what you've written about the virus, I was careful to observe the dates. January 22nd feels like a long time ago. Has a lot changed over the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, definitely. I know this outbreak's really been moving very quickly. So as you pointed out, the number of cases has really skyrocketed in the last couple of weeks, especially in China. There's most of the deaths have also been in China at this point. So although it is a risk to countries around the world, it's really most severe within China at the moment.
All right. So the key there then is that we need not panic in places that are not China, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, and that's not to say that, you know, we don't need to be vigilant. Obviously, there have been cases in, I think, close to 24 or maybe more than 24 countries at this point. So, but the thing that we are watching out for is whether or not those cases are, leading to sustained transmission of the virus, which means that it spreads, you know, widely from person to person within those countries. And so far, there have been a couple of documented cases of spread within families. And then there was a case of someone in Germany who had traveled from China and transmitted the virus to some colleagues in Germany. But as of now, we haven't seen the sort of widespread transmission that you would see in places like China.
That's a good nuts and bolts thing, though, to convey, though. I mean, how is the coronavirus spread?
So we think it's a respiratory virus, or we know that, actually. So it seems to be spread by droplets in the air. So that's when people are coughing or sneezing, you know, like a typical cold, for example. We don't yet know whether it can be spread on surfaces, but that's something that health officials are looking into. But, yeah, we do know it's very transmissible. It's even more transmissible than flu, so it's something to be careful of.
You brought up flu at the exact right time, because we've been urged by a few observers to keep the novel coronavirus in perspective, that more people will get the flu in our country. Is that fair, and can you give some comparisons?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a good comparison, that the flu is still probably a much greater threat to members of the public in the U.S. and many other countries. It's an especially bad flu season this year, so that's definitely the first thing that we need to watch out for. But as I mentioned, as the coronavirus spreads, we do need to be aware that there is a potential for that to become a bigger threat. But at the moment, flu really is the larger immediate threat.
From covering the flu in the past, what are the usual factors that will make for a bad flu season like this one? Is it just a matter of mismatch on vaccines, or not people getting enough of them, or weather, or all of the above?
Yeah, so, as you know, every year health authorities have to put together a flu vaccine, and they kind of have to guess which strains they think are going to be most prevalent that year. And it seems like this year, the strains that are most widely circulating are not very well protected against in the vaccine. So although it's always a good idea to be vaccinated and vaccines do provide some level of protection, it just seems as though this year the strain of flu that's going around is not one of the ones that they had guessed. So I think, the important thing is to just continue to take normal precautions like washing your hands, staying home if you're sick. All of these are just generally good advice for avoiding respiratory infections.
So it sounds like what they do is they formulate the flu vaccine, because they think A and B are going to be the dominant strains, and when C and D show up, we're not protected?
Yeah, basically. So they don't have a lot of information to go off of when they have to develop the vaccine, because it happens before the flu season really hits. So they kind of have to make an educated guess based on what's going on, like in the southern hemisphere, for example, and then decide which strains they think are going to be predominant in the northern hemisphere flu season, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So they basically pick three or four different flu strains and include those in the vaccine. But as we have seen, sometimes just by chance, a particular strain that's not part of the vaccine will be circulating more widely.
Mm-hmm. So, Tanya, I knew I was going to do that at least at one point. Darn you, Tanya Tucker. So, Tanya Lewis, in your time covering health and medicine, how does the size and speed of the coronavirus outbreak compare to others you've covered?
So, I mean, it's definitely been compared most to SARS, which is the virus that caused an outbreak in 2003 in Asia and other countries, and basically was in some ways, you know, it was had a higher mortality rate, but at the same time, it was did not infect nearly as many people so far. So I guess, you know, it's kind of hard to make comparisons between various viruses, but we are seeing that this new coronavirus, which is actually very closely related to SARS, so far seems to be, you know, possibly less lethal at this point, but it seems to be certainly very transmissible. So, and then, you know, just in terms of comparing it to other types of outbreaks, like, for example, the Ebola outbreak, obviously Ebola was a very lethal virus, but at the same time, it doesn't transmit very well between people. And actually, epidemiologists have a number that they use to kind of quantify how well a virus spreads.
That's the R number, the reproduction number?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to get to that. We have to take a break right now, though. Tanya Lewis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the understanding of the coronavirus. She is an associate editor at Scientific American. She covers health and medicine. We'll come back and talk more with Tanya. If you'd like to join us with your phone calls and emails, please do that. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. I want to come back to some basics here, Tanya. Why is it called novel coronavirus?
So basically, they haven't come up with the official name yet. This is just an interim name. It's, you know, the process of naming a virus is goes through kind of a complicated process. But one of the reasons that they take a while to do it is that they want to be careful not to just name it after, for example, the city where it first appeared, because
they don't do the Spanish flu thing, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So you kind of just want to be careful with that. But right now, that's the interim name that they've given to the virus.
Okay, so yeah, I can see how the city fathers and mothers in Wuhan would object to this being called the Wuhan virus. So novel is just a handle to put it. Novel because it's new.
Yeah. So basically, coronaviruses are a family of viruses that we've known about for a long time. In fact, something like a fifth of cases of the common cold are actually caused by mild coronaviruses. And the name coronavirus just refers to, if you actually look at the virus, like under a microscope, there are these proteins on the outside of the virus that resemble the spikes of the sun's corona, sort of like a crown-like shape.
Okay.
So that's where the name comes from.
Okay, so it is about the shape, not from their infection characteristics or anything like that.
Right.
Okay, but so this is interesting because it's so some colds are caused by coronavirus, not all, you're saying?
Yeah, there are other ones caused by rhinoviruses, for example. But we don't exactly know why some coronaviruses are mild and some are more severe, but there are some clues just from what we've learned from SARS, for example, about, you know, which part of the respiratory tract gets infected, whether it's the sort of nose and upper respiratory tract, like the nose and throat, versus the lungs, which this newer virus seems to be more targeting, you know, the lungs. And that's why it causes this pneumonia.
Okay, that's interesting. So it does take a different approach. Instead of the upper respiratory, it works on the lungs. And I remember reading one of the accounts of one of the earlier patients, and it sounded like he was just drowning inside his lungs.
Yeah, there does seem to be quite a range of severity in terms of cases. Some patients certainly have developed a deadly pneumonia, and in those cases, I think most of the people that have actually died from the virus at this point have been generally older, above the age of 60, and generally had other underlying health conditions as well. But there have definitely been some milder cases that we just don't know how many mild cases are out there at this point.
Now, some of the questions you're going to hear now are going to mimic your interview with Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Now, first, since that was 2 weeks ago, have there been any major developments since that interview that changed our view of the virus or its spread?
Yeah. So, I mean, well, it's, you know, hard to kind of look back 2 weeks ago and think about the fact that this was a new virus. You know, we really only had heard of a few dozen cases, and now it's, you know, as you said, in the tens of thousands of cases in China and several hundred around the world. So certainly in terms of the degree of how many cases there are and how widespread it is, we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about how transmissible the virus is. There have been, you know, documented cases in of transmission within families and even to healthcare workers. So we know it is pretty highly transmissible. We've learned more about the genetic sequence of the virus. You know, Chinese scientists sequenced the genome of the virus a couple of weeks ago and made that available to scientists around the world, and they've basically been able to confirm that it is very closely related to the SARS virus that emerged in 2002 and 2003. But yeah, we basically are still trying to understand exactly how deadly it is, what percentage of people are getting this severe pneumonia versus a milder infection, and there's just still a lot of unknowns out there in terms of understanding what will happen with the outbreak.
No, understanding the genome, that does help us understand, like, basically which family of viruses it comes from, that sort of thing, so that, as you point out, it sounds like it can potentially help with treatment or vaccines or something.
Yeah, so, I mean, well, in theory, there are definitely several groups working on a vaccine at the moment, but the issue here is that it generally takes months, if not years, to even develop a candidate vaccine, and then you have to test it for safety. And so that's really something that's on the horizon, but not going to be ready anytime soon. There was a lot of work to develop a vaccine for SARS, so scientists are able to kind of piggyback on some of that work, and that's been enabling them to kind of accelerate the development of vaccines. But at this point, it's going to be, you know, probably at least a year before any kind of vaccine might be available.
So let me understand, did we ever develop a vaccine for SARS itself?
So they did develop a candidate, I believe, but the outbreak itself kind of petered out before they got to the stage where they were going to widely test it and, you know, market it. So there's sort of a candidate vaccine that they can work from, but it was never actually fully approved for use.
So, like any story in the news, there are layers of counter information and backlash that quickly come atop the real facts. I mean, does it still appear that a so-called wet market in Wuhan is the source, the original source of the novel coronavirus?
So, as far as I know, that is still the primary culprit. Obviously, epidemiologists will have to go and investigate and look into what the exact source was. We do think that the virus probably originated in bats ultimately, but there were no bats at that wet market as far as we know. So it's likely that there was some sort of intermediate host, some other type of animal that would have been exposed to bats, but that then could have transferred the virus to humans in the market. But we're still trying to figure out what that animal might be.
So, and we talk about wet market. I mean, is this just basically a market that sells animals whole or parts that and there are tanks of them?
Yeah. So that basically it's just like a wild, you know, they sell some combination of farm animals and other wild animals. And I believe this was a seafood market, but they did sell wild game animals as well. And, you know, in the past, outbreaks like SARS, I believe, was originally tied to something similar, where you have people exposed to wild animals that have the virus, and then it sort of jumps into humans for reasons that we don't completely understand. But
mm-hmm. In theory, it's supposed to be fairly hard for pathogens to jump from animals to humans, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly has happened multiple times in the past. That's how the Ebola virus first arose. That was another virus that came from bats and was later found to infect humans. So, yeah, basically any disease that jumps from animals to humans, it's called a zoonosis. And that is something that infectious disease scientists are constantly vigilant for, because they, you know, these are totally new diseases that we just haven't had any experience with yet. And it's certainly something that scientists are concerned about.
We're talking to Tanya Lewis, an associate editor at Scientific America, and she covers health and medicine and has written a couple of articles, or parts of a couple of articles, about novel coronavirus, and helping us understand where it comes from, what it's been doing, and its virulence. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. If you have questions or comments, visit with us at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. How do you even pronounce the shorthand for what we're calling this novel coronavirus? Because, it could be 2019-nCoV or 2019-nCoV, or, what's the lingo around the office?
I think just 2019 nCoV, or I'm not sure what people are calling it, among science circles, but I think at this point most people are just kind of referring to it as the novel coronavirus. It is important to note that there are other kinds of coronaviruses out there.
All right. This is how you just differentiate between the other coronaviruses and this one. This one is always going to have 2019-nCoV.
Yeah, at least until they come up with a more official name.
Okay. I read the piece yesterday that you talked about 10 minutes ago, where you were one of three writers, about the basic reproduction number. What is that, and what do we know about the number for this novel coronavirus?
Sure. So the basic reproduction number is just a measure of how many people an infected person can go on and infect in a population that's completely susceptible to the virus. So it's gives scientists an idea of, the baseline value of how infectious a disease is. So just for reference, if that number, the R-naught, as it's called, is greater than 1, then we know that the outbreak will continue to spread. But if it's less than 1, it will eventually peter out. And so scientists are really interested in kind of calculating what this value might be. And we can kind of look at we can get a sense of how severe it is by comparing that R-naught value with other outbreaks. For example, measles has an R-naught of between 12 and 18,
wow,
somewhere around there. So that's a very infectious disease, obviously. But it's the mortality rate is actually lower than many other diseases. For comparison, the current coronavirus is thought to be somewhere in the range of 2 to 3, depending on which estimate you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that if you are an infected person, you can infect 2 or 3 additional people. And you can see how that could very quickly mushroom into many, many cases, because one infected person can go on and infect 2 to 3 people, who can then go in and infect 2 to 3 more, and so on.
Do we know where in the exposure cycle the novel coronavirus is most transmittable?
So you mean in terms of the number of
Is it on you before you can deliver it to somebody else, or that sort of thing?
So I think the estimate, there's a large range, conservative range of something like 2 to 14 days. That's why you're seeing these quarantines that are for up to 14 days, because we just don't know whether somebody's able to transmit the virus for more than, it could be up to 14 days. So that's sort of a conservative estimate. But we think at this point, you know, people can transmit the virus when they're symptomatic, and with respiratory infections, that's typically the range of time that you show symptoms.
We have an email here from Scott in Ashland who says, I was shocked recently to see the figures for the number of deaths attributable to influenza in the U.S. this year, which dwarf those so far in China from the new coronavirus. How does the mortality rate from the novel coronavirus appear to compare to that of influenza? And that again from Scott in Ashland.
Yeah, so it's true that the flu does cause, you know, a significant number of deaths. However, the reason that people are kind of taking this new virus so seriously is because it does have a fairly high fatality rate among those who are infected. It's about 2% at the moment, although those numbers could change as we find more mild infections, for example. But right now, as of right now, the mortality rate is, you know, fairly, it's on the higher side compared to flu. The reason that flu is a big concern is that just so many more people are infected with flu, and it's transmitting much more widely in the U.S. and other countries at this point. So at this point, yes, flu is a bigger risk, as I mentioned earlier, but the coronavirus is still something that we need to be kind of vigilant about, because it can be, you know, can seems to cause more deaths overall.
Scott, thanks for the question. Appreciate that. We're talking again with Tanya Lewis, an associate editor at Scientific American. Do you happen to know off the top of your head what the R-naught is for, the reproduction number is for this year's flu strain?
So I think in general, flu's reproduction number is somewhere around 1.3, so mm-hmm. It's slightly less transmissible than the new coronavirus, but obviously greater than one, so it is able to continue spreading. Mm-hmm. But yes.
I guess the thing you've really shocked me with above all else so far is the reproduction number for measles. I mean, I knew it was highly contagious, but wow, R12 to R18, when compared to maybe R2 or 3 for the novel coronavirus, measles really gets around.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason that you hear health officials talking about the importance of vaccination, because it's important to remember that although the R-naught does tell you about the sort of inherent transmissibility of a virus, that number, the reproduction number can actually change depending on, you know, if there are more people vaccinated in the population, you can dramatically lower the reproduction number. Or if people are taking measures to kind of wash their hands and be careful not to get sick, that can also lower the reproduction number. But yes, vaccination is definitely an important part of lowering the risk of transmission.
I assume you were involved with covering SARS in 2003. Is that a safe assumption?
To be honest, I was still in high school, but I was, you know, following it, you know, just as a member of the public.
And, the reason I ask is just I was curious about comparisons with what we've seen here, where, for example, Travis Air Force Base got a plane load of Americans who had been evacuated from China, and they're going to be under quarantine for 2 weeks. I just don't remember that happening with SARS.
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons for that difference is that, you know, with this outbreak, we did kind of know fairly early on that it was happening. With SARS, it seems like there was a delay, you know, basically as the outbreak was unfolding in China, it was not very widely known in the rest of the world. So I guess the difference here is that we knew it was happening and we could start to take steps to kind of prevent it from, or limit the risk of it spreading to the U.S. Obviously, there have been a handful of cases within the U.S., but quarantines are only really effective if it's not already widely transmitted. And with SARS, I believe there were not, you know, many cases in the U.S. Compared with China, obviously. So I don't think it was as big of a risk, but certainly, yeah, the difference is that we kind of knew that this was a risk that was coming ahead of time, and, you know, we're just trying to limit the spread.
Okay, just a quick answer because we're almost out of time. Tanya, really challenging environment for journalists to try to keep up with the twists and turns of this story?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's certainly keeping us busy and as we're getting more information every day.
All right. But, Tanya Lewis is covering the novel coronavirus with other people at the Scientific American, where she's an associate editor covering health and medicine. Thank you so much for joining us today and enlightening us a bit about the dangers of novel coronavirus.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Short break on the Jefferson Exchange. When we come back, you will hear Josh Gross with this month's edition of Rogue Sounds, Bands on the Run, coming up.